From the Sky News Centre at 5, Vincent Tabak has been found guilty of murdering Bristol architect Joanna Yates and sentenced to life behind bars. The judge, Mr Justice Field, said he'd attacked her for sexual thrills, telling him he was wicked, deceitful and manipulative. He added it was a dreadful, evil act on a vulnerable young woman. In a statement read by a family liaison officer outside court, Joanna's parents said capital punishment would have been a fairer sentence.
The best we can hope for him is that he spends the rest of his life incarcerated, where his life is a living hell, being the recipient of all evils, deprivations and degradations that his situation can provide.
Detective Chief Inspector Phil Jones from Avon and Somerset Police led the murder inquiry. After the verdict, he fought back tears as he delivered a statement outside court. He said Joanna's parents acted with dignity and patience throughout the investigation and trial.
Vincent Tabak will spend a considerable time behind bars, but for them, each day and every Christmas will be time when all they have is a memory of a daughter who was taken from them.
In other news, protesters camped outside St Paul's Cathedral are facing legal action from the City of London Corporation. The announcement was made as the cathedral opened its doors again this lunchtime. The main river running through Bangkok has swelled to record highs, briefly flooding riverside buildings. Thousands of people have left the Thai capital as the floods are expected to continue for 6 weeks. David Cameron's called on company boards to act responsibly when making pay awards. It comes after a report revealed that directors at the country's top firms have seen their salaries rise by 49% in the past year. Average earnings are just short of £2.7 million. And the largest, heaviest and most valuable gold coin in the world has been unveiled in Western Australia. It's been made by the Perth Mint and weighs a ton. On one side is a kangaroo with the queen on the other. It measures 80 centimetres wide and 12 centimetres deep and is valued at £250,000. That's the latest. I'm Claire Gregory.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review this week's news is parliamentary candidate for the English Democrat Party, Ray Carr. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, an exclusive report from Norway on far-right Masonic terrorist Anders Behring Breivik, the man behind this August's Oslo bombing, which killed 8 and seriously injured 10 people, and the subsequent Ireland massacre, where another 69 young Norwegian Labour Party members on summer camp were executed, and 66 more were seriously injured. And the British Constitution in the crosshairs this week as our MPs yet again deny us a referendum on Europe. We talked to a constitutional campaigner, and after a wannabe politician failed to become candidate for Witney in Oxfordshire, the rest is history. The eventually successful candidate's name is now familiar to us all. It's none other than Prime Minister David Cameron. And Martin Summers rounds up the international stories of the week for us as part of our Halloween politics special. Sticking with Call Me Dave, here's Boris Johnson's and George Osborne's Bullingdon Club. How come so many members make it to positions of power? Plus, we return to take another look at the invite-only leadership charity Common Purpose at the council, the BBC and in the police and other public services. Do some of their so-called graduates have their fingers in the till, placing orders for more training from, guess who, Common Purpose? Or is their course so good, it's public money well spent? And finally, on the day changes to the accession to the throne are announced, we hear from Jewish author, former of the US Navy, Tim Cohen, about what he believes are corrupt orders of knighthood here in Britain, with links that have been secretly tightening their grip on power for centuries. A Halloween story indeed, and not for the faint-hearted. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 6 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 16 degrees. degrees Celsius. Fairly cloudy with a few sunny spells and a few showers. Also a bit windy. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, staying pretty much the same as the weekend. Drier and sunnier towards the beginning of the week, wetter towards the end of the week, and windy again. Next weekend, that's the 5th and 6th of November, highs of 10 Celsius, sunny spells and windy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, trying to introduce this week's guests now. Joining us is a parliamentary candidate for the English Democrat Party, Ray Carr. Hi, Ray, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi there.
Now, first of all, tell us a bit about the English Democrat Party, because it's one of those that we see there on the ballots if we're voters. What do you actually stand for?
OK. The English Democrats actually came into being in 2002. It started with a guy from Essex, and he started the party because he felt that after the 1997 Devolution Act, he felt that the people of England were really being done out of a lot. So that's where it began. It began in Essex, and the reason it came into being was because of devolution.
So what's the reflection then in Bristol? What's the actual aims of the party? What, you know, if you were to get some MPs into power, because you stand in quite a large swathe across England, what would you actually do if you got into power?
If we got into power, the first thing we would want to do is to get basically the same as the people of Scotland and the people of Wales. That would be a parliament for England. At the moment, you have Westminster, which supposedly represents the British, but you have Scotland got their own assembly, and you've got Scotland got their own parliament, and Wales got their own assembly, and Northern Ireland got their own assembly. But it seems that England really have got nothing.
So you're not in favour of the United Kingdom, the UK, with including Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Wales as well?
When you say we're not in favour, we would be quite happy to have a federal UK, whereby we can all get together, talk, but it seems quite clear to me that Alex Salmond would love to go for independence. Now, if that's what Scotland wants, then it's up to Scotland, and if Wales wants it, really it's up to Wales. But where does it leave England? So we do feel that the first thing we need is a parliament for the people of England.
And surely we've got one already. It's called Westminster.
Well, that, as I said, is a British parliament. It isn't an English parliament. Is voted on in Westminster is voted on by Welsh MPs, by Scottish MPs, by English MPs, by Irish MPs. Well, we feel that is terribly unfair when, truly, the English as itself are getting no benefits whatsoever.
Well, there's very little representation, is there, in certainly in Scotland or in Wales for the Conservatives. So it sounds to me like you're in favour of permanent Conservative rule, because if it was an English parliament, the Conservatives would be some of the biggest winners as a party.
Not necessarily, because I think you'll find if people voted for the English Democrats, they would have a party that represented the people of England. The Conservatives, I believe, have been is an old party. It's been around a long time. Much as the Liberal Party, I know the Liberal Democrats is a new party as such, but the Liberals is an old party. We in the English Democrats believe that we really do want to help the people of England. Now, let's just look at some of the policies at the moment. You have Scotland, they're able to have university tuition free, whereas the people in England got to pay £9,000. You have prescription charges in both Scotland and Wales free, but in England, you've got to pay for it. Now, we do feel this is totally unfair, and this is why we feel that if there was an English Parliament, and especially run by the English Democrats, we would look after the people of England.
Now, let me bring old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers in here.
Hello.
Martin, just on this particular point about the idea of having an English Parliament as something separate to Westminster, do you think it's a runner?
I think ultimately it will be because of what's happening in Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. I think also one of the things I would add is if we had PR in elections to that English Parliament, then it wouldn't necessarily be a Conservative-dominated
proportional representation.
Because, of course, that's what's made the difference. And if you look at the British Constitution now, it's a bit of a botched job. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but ultimately we're going to have to put some kind of overall pattern on it that's logical. If you look at the German constitution, it was written on paper in 1945, you know, to be a kind of, you know, so that the local the Länder, the big regional parts of Germany have their own parliaments, and there's a national parliament as well. Now ultimately these questions are going to have to be raised here. What we've actually got in Britain is that the people who run Britain is England. This is what's felt on the periphery, is England is a bit like Serbia in the Yugoslav Federation. They tend to dominate, and it's not, when it's not the ordinary people of England, it's the people in charge in England, you know, the kind of people that are sitting in the cabinet now, you know, 17 millionaires out of 23, mostly privately educated, many of them going to Eton. Now this is because our system is basically knackered, old-fashioned, and, you know, designed for the 19th century. We need a modern system, and within a modern system, having an English Parliament would make sense. But I think we'd probably want to keep a federation. I mean, even in Northern Ireland, that would be the case, because the Loyalists wouldn't want to leave. So you know, we'd have to create some kind of structure. But I can't see there's any real problem with having an English Parliament as part of that structure in the long run. Why not?
Ray, what are your policies on immigration? Because one of the things that we hear often with the generally sort of right of centre parties is that they're accused often of racism. Yeah. But what's your policy on immigration, and to what extent is it could it be thought of as a racist policy?
The EDP, the English Democrat Party's policy on immigration is a point system. Now, if you look at our manifesto, we make it quite clear that we recognise the fact that there are people who employers would need to employ from outside of this country. But we believe that the way forward is the same basically as Australia, Canada, and have a point system. That is the way the English Democrats would look at it.
What about the existing migrants? Because, you know, we've heard population figures of Britain's population going up to 70 million this week.
Yeah.
So, I mean, surely you're shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, aren't you?
It seems that the our three major parties, i.e. Labour, Tory and Liberal Democrats, for over the years, especially in the last 10 years with the Labour government, have, as you say, allowed so many immigrants in, it's getting very, very, in my opinion, overpopulated.
Martin, what about this idea of overpopulation? I mean, isn't this really a housing problem?
No, well, listen, every state in the world has controls over who can move in and out of that state. There is no place in the world which has complete free entry. And what I would say is that it's got to be fair and transparent. This is a modern world now. Everybody moves everywhere. Everybody's got relatives who are living and working abroad. It's a normal thing. But, of course, you can't just have everybody going everywhere. But I'm afraid the problem is that we're going to have an economic collapse, wars are breaking out, and people are going to get on the move when that happens. And of course they like to come to nice places where the people are friendly and welcoming, as generally people in this country are. And in a way, it's a compliment to us that people want to come here. And we don't want to lose our good reputation by being nasty to people for the sake of it. But on the other hand, of course, we've got to have a clear policy, and a point system is a logical way to go.
But Ray, you haven't told us about the English Democrats' manifesto, which says that you would actually pull out of treaties on asylum and immigration. And asylum is quite a serious issue, isn't it? Some people who are being threatened in other parts of the world need to come to Britain, especially if it's our planes that are bombing them, potentially, or that they've upset people that we've put in place, the British, you know, sort of puppet rulers in other parts of the world. What about the asylum seekers? Why would we pull out of a treaty that we've signed, an international treaty, on asylum?
Well, I would say there, like all people of compassion, for asylum seekers, if a person is truly being dealt a royal blow, being threatened for death and so forth in another country, then yes, the possibilities are we should take them. But the sad thing is, in this country, you've got a lot of asylum seekers coming in now who are not threatened and who are doing very well, thank you very much. But because of what our friend did say, we are good to them, we are very tolerant, and we allow people to come in left, right and centre, I think the problems are going to rise. Now, I think if you look at unemployment, we see, especially among the young now, you could say from 16 to 24, there's a lot of unemployed. Now, it's going to create, I believe, many problems with the young if they cannot get themselves jobs.
Well, one of the things your manifesto says is that entry should be determined by our needs as a society. Now, that doesn't include those who are being threatened abroad, does it?
I think you'll find, if you speak to the leader of the English Democrats, a bloke called Robin, he would not look at it in that light. We have in the party people from Israel, i.e. Jews. We have people from other nationalities and who have came into this party and see it as a party for England. And they don't feel as though they're being misrepresented at all. I see where you're coming from. If we're going to have a point system, then who do we have and who don't we? But I think when you're looking at employment and you're looking at asylum, I think really they are two different areas.
That's right.
Okay, now this week we've had, on Monday, a debate in the House of Commons about Europe and whether we should have a referendum over our membership of Europe. This is a big thing which has really been troubled the Conservative Party for probably 20, 30 years now. What's your party's view on what happened on Monday and what you saw?
Well, I don't know the party's view on what happened on Monday, but a party's view on Europe is quite simple. We would like to come out of Europe completely.
Why?
Right. To start with, we look at the amount of money we pay into Europe, which is about, I've been given to understand, £68 billion per year. And we're being told all the time by the politicians that our industries and so forth need Europe. Well, years ago, we were given plenty of jobs from overseas, i.e. New Zealand, Australia, from all over the world. So when we joined the common market, which in those days was just a place for whereby you would transfer your goods and nothing else, we were told quite clearly that that is what the common market was. Now we have a situation where you're becoming a united Europe. So what's happening as I see it, you're going to have the Westminster, whether we like it or not, being redundant. Because everything is being, all our policies and everything now are being made by Brussels. And quite honestly, I myself feel as though, what is the point of an English Parliament, of a Westminster Parliament, if we are being completely controlled by Brussels?
Okay, and there's been lots of stuff going on this week, hasn't there, over the Eurozone. Martin, the Eurozone debt crisis deal, which was on Thursday morning, we were told about all that. Apparently a deal has been struck. Apparently we have a €440 billion European Financial Stability Facility now. Great one that rolls straight off the tongue, doesn't it? And a state-sponsored insurance scheme, which will ensure a buyer of Italian bonds will get a payout if Italy were to default. And this idea of having an insurance scheme to back it up, what it actually means is that this EFSF, the European Financial Stability Facility, doesn't actually have any cash involved. It's all kind of these kind of derivative instruments. I don't know if derivative is quite the right word, but insurance policies, which doesn't sound like real cash. In fact, it's not real cash.
Well, Sarkozy is going to China as we speak to persuade the Chinese to stump up for this fund. Okay.
Well, apparently they don't want to. Already they've said they don't want to. So he's going to go and try and twist their arms.
This deal is going to unravel. And it's what nearly happened this week is if Greece was ordered to be properly in default, that's 50% of its debts are supposedly written off on Wednesday night, but that would potentially put Greece into default. Now, if Greece goes into default, that triggers all the credit default swaps in London, in Frankfurt, and in Wall Street, and the banking system was on the verge of collapse. Now, the euro is a big problem because it's been badly designed and all the rest of it, but the issue isn't really the euro, the issue is the banking system. And what will happen if Greece defaults? And what's the banks have supposedly agreed this 50% cut in what they're owed, but they've said we'll only agree to that if the European Union or people in the European Union or somebody else pays us off for that. So what we're talking about here is another bank bailout. We had a bank bailout from the British government in 2008. This is now a bank bailout from the European government, potentially, and just as in the US. And they're trying to make the Germans print money to pay for it. And the Germans are not very happy about that. But ultimately, I'm afraid, leaving aside where parliaments are sat or whatever, you're just saying that we're run from Brussels. Well, we're also run from Wall Street and by the Pentagon, and we've got massive US bases on our soil, and they start wars without telling us what they're doing. The French kicked the Americans out in 1960. We haven't done so. And of course, the French and the Germans at one stage didn't want Britain in the European Union because they always felt that we were going to be basically a Trojan horse for the Americans, because the whole idea of the European Union was to break away from American domination. Now, what's actually happening is we're now in a world where everybody is about to fight for their corner in a situation where the economy is collapsing and so on.
Well, when you say fight, do you mean financially or war?
I mean in every way, because when you deprive people of funds, that is the next step. You know, what do you do before you go to war? You have sanctions, and then you start shooting. And there are shooting wars going on as we speak. We know very well. I mean, the British armed forces are deployed across the globe as we speak. Probably some of them have died today somewhere out there. So to say, well, is it a war? Yeah, well, yes, it is. And this is the problem, is the system as a whole, we're talking about the economic system now, not the political system, is in a hell of a mess. And what I would say as a Labour activist is that we've got an internationalist approach. I'm not against people having national identities and national struggles, of course not. But we've also got to think in a global way. And I would hope that if the English Democrats ever came to power in this country, they would think in a global way as well. We're all international citizens as well as citizens of the countries that we belong to. And we've got to start thinking like that.
No man's an island. I quite agree.
Okay, and we'll hear a bit more from you, Ray, in a minute on that one. But first of all, Alistair Darling and Nigel Lawson, the BBC, got their reaction straight away on Thursday when the results of this Eurozone fix were announced. So let's have a listen to former Chancellors Alistair Darling and Nigel Lawson.
Until we actually know how much of a write-down banks are taking, until we know that Greece has a plan that can be implemented and delivered upon, there's going to be uncertainty. Similarly, if you look at the banking recapitalisation, it worked here 3 years ago because we were able to say how much was going to be put into the banks, how much was public money, which banks were affected and so on, and that gave confidence. And the third element, of course, is this rescue fund. There's a query as to whether it's big enough, but also what it is, because it looks like it's not going to be cash. It's going to be some sort of sophisticated financial instrument. And, you know, people are rightly wary of those because many of them contributed to the problems we've got at the present time. So, yes, they've made progress, but there's an awful long time, it seems, between now and when we'll actually get the detail which will provide the reassurance that I think people are looking for.
This certainly doesn't solve the Eurozone problem, not least because the Eurozone problem is insoluble. It can't be solved, it can only be dissolved. And that is what's going to happen in the end. This needs to be done in an orderly fashion, because you cannot have a monetary union that is satisfactory without a fiscal union, a tax union, and you cannot have that in a democratic setup, and we're going to be a democracy, without full political integration. And that is not something that anybody, or pretty well no major country in the European Union, wants that. So the thing was always a non-starter. However, we are where we are, and therefore what we have got to do is to buy time, and that is what this agreement does. It doesn't buy enough time, but it begins the process, or continues the process, of buying time to enable the banks, who are loaded with sovereign debt, which is worth only a fraction of its nominal amount, to replenish their reserves and their capital.
People will worry that if Greece is still going to be in this position in several years' time, what does that mean for other economies? And that's why I said that what we needed to get from the Eurozone last night is not just the bank write-down, that's an important part of it, but actually, is there a workable plan? Because nobody actually believes that the plan presently being implemented or attempted in Greece is actually going to deliver the goods, because they've lost so much of their capacity to grow that it's unlikely they'll service these loans, let alone repay them. Which is, brings me to the other thing that wasn't really discussed last night, and that is, if you don't get growth, you will never get your deficit down. And that affects us in this country as much as it does European countries. I know it's a difficult subject for the current European leaders because they're all following similar policies, but if we don't get growth, then this problem is just simply going to go on and on and on. So that's why I say yesterday was fine, several months too late, but it's nowhere near enough to where we need to be.
That was the former Chancellor, the last Chancellor before George Osborne, Alistair Darling there speaking on Thursday after the announcement of the Eurozone fix. Martin, nobody believes that this is going to work. That's what Alistair Darling actually said there.
That's true, which is why it's surprising that the markets went up on Thursday and Friday. And although the Italian bond issue this morning was apparently disappointing, what tends to happen, what you've got to remember, the way stock markets work is that as long as you've got this, what you do is you bet where the market's going to be. So if everybody thinks that everybody else is going to be happy for 24 hours, then you park your money where they're happiest and then you make your money. So the markets work like a little herd. Yeah. So as soon as they've come up with what sounds like a satisfactory deal, there's a feel-good factor which runs for a day, 2 days, 3 days, and then people look at the small print and go, oh no, in actual fact this isn't going to work. Now in actual fact it isn't going to work because the banks are bust. The banks went bust in 2008. The state stepped in, all sorts of states, the British state, the European state, the American state, stepped in and bailed out the market. And then people thought, well, eventually this is going to be all right. But of course, the governments have now run out of money and the banks are still bust. What they really need to do, what they should have done, is properly nationalise the banks and basically wind up most of the existing banking system. Bankrupt them, sack the existing managers who are clearly incompetent, and set up a new system which is run under democratic control by public authorities. But that everybody's fighting shy of that. What we're doing is just paying more money to the blackmailers, and the blackmailers are making a lot of money. It was in the FT yesterday, the top FTSE top 100 companies, their managers, had a 44% pay rise last year.
Well, King Mervyn has also said, Ray, this week, this is Mervyn King, Governor of the Bank of England, that will only give us a year or two at the most breathing space.
Well, I think regarding the whole economic disaster which we've had at this present moment in time, or you could say from 2008, I think it goes back far, far beyond that. See, I think if you think of the way in this country house prices for a start started going up and up and up in the 90s, 2000, and it was as though people could go and buy a house and they had no money, yet they could get 120% mortgages. Now, I think if we look at... I think we've got to come back to reality and look at the way the banks, again, have given people without jobs plastic cards. Go out, buy this, buy that. Now, I think the biggest problem is debt. Because in America, in this country, in Europe, we've spent so much money on plastic. House prices have gone up out of all proportion. How can you have a houses going at 150,000? I bought my first house in 1973 for £7,000. Okay, wages were not as good as they are now, but by God, it's just gone ridiculous. And governments of all persuasions have allowed everything just to go out of control. Banks have not been regulated. There's been no regulation at all to keep things under control.
So how would you do things then?
How would I do things? I'll be honest with you.
Martin's just laid his stall out there. He wants to nationalise
the banks. I think to begin with, I would have allowed... Now, this is me. Now, we have economic experts within the English Democrats. I am not an economic expert. I will say, though, in my own thoughts, is that in Iceland, they allowed their banks to go under. I think we should have done the same when Northern Rock went down. We should have let everything go under and start afresh.
Martin, is that realistic to actually if you let things go under, what happens is you end up with a banking crash. That could be far worse, couldn't it?
No,
than actually bailing out. That allows continuity, the bailout.
Well, no, but what you should do is you should allow it to go under at an earlier stage when it's actually not going to be so disastrous.
But we can't turn back time, can we?
No. What we've now got is a situation where criminalised banks are basically, we bailed them out. They used the money that they were bailed out with to lobby, because of course a lot of money goes into politics. You know, things like Obama's election campaign, all paid for by the banks, which were bailed out. And the same with the Conservative Party here, and basically they've captured policy. instead of nationalising the banks, what happened in 2008 is that the banks are starting to privatise the state and the government, and it's now becoming clear who actually runs the country, and it's not the elected politicians, and it's not the ordinary people. We've got a financial oligarchy in this country which has been in power for generations, actually, and they've always run the show, and by and large people have been happy to let them run the show because at least they looked as if they were competent. But what's now beginning to dawn on the ordinary people is they're not even competent, and at that point we're going to need our democracy like never before to argue through the necessary changes that are going to have to be made. But there's going to have to be some pain, and I would suggest that's all got to be at the top. There is no reason whatsoever why the poor people at the bottom who've done nothing to bring this crisis about should pay a single penny or make any kind of sacrifices. The people before financial deregulation in 1987, the millionaires were millionaires and the poor people were poor. They're now billionaires. They've done very well out of financial deregulation, and now it's all gone sour. Now those who benefited must be those who pay, but of course they don't want to pay. They're paying the politicians to prevent themselves being made to pay, and if we try and go into the streets to stop them, they're going to get out the guns, because that's the reality. In Greece they know all about that. They had a military dictator from 1967 to 1974, backed by the Western
powers. Well, it may not come to that, Martin, because on Wednesday, a federal grand jury in Manhattan charged Mr. Gupta, that is to say Rajat K. Gupta, former director of Goldman Sachs and Procter & Gamble, with one count of conspiracy to commit securities fraud and five counts of securities fraud. Now, he is actually a former Goldman Sachs director, and so it seems like there are some people who are being arrested for this at the highest levels.
Yeah, but in the 1980s, during the savings and loans collapse in the United States, 3,500 people were sent to prison. Now, at this stage, in a much bigger collapse with a much greater level of fraud, we've had a handful of people sent to prison. And I'm glad to see people are being prosecuted, but the reason why they haven't pushed prosecutions is because all the accounting that they've been doing is Enron-style accounting.
Well, that's interesting you mentioned that, because we hear on Saturday last week that the Big Four auditors are going to face an investigation. PricewaterhouseCoopers, KPMG, Deloitte and Ernst & Young have been referred to the Competition Commission after the Office of Fair Trading ruled the audit market is too concentrated. The competition authorities are launching a full-scale inquiry into the Big Four auditors, which earn nearly 99% of the fees paid by the UK's biggest companies.
Well, I mean, the fact is, you see, what you do with an auditor is you buy the auditor that you want. So, of course, the auditors tell the people who are buying the audit what they want to hear, otherwise they ain't going to get the work. That's what Arthur Andersen did with Enron. Basically, Enron was setting up all of these dodgy accounts and hiding away losses in structured investment vehicles, and Arthur Andersen signed it off because they wanted the contract. And if Arthur Andersen hadn't signed it off, somebody else would have taken the contract and signed it off instead. Now, this is how corrupt this whole thing is. The market's supposed to sort it out. The market isn't going to sort it out because the market's bent.
John Fingleton, I think, might even agree with you. He's from the Office of Fair Trading, their chief executive. He said the market for large company audits lacks sufficient competition and doesn't work well for customers. It's highly concentrated and largely supplied by these four big firms, with clients rarely switching between auditors. There's also high barriers to entry for new and small companies. These are not the indicators of a competitive market.
Yeah, but the point about a competitive market in this is companies buying their auditors. So let's say we had 100 different auditors instead of four. The companies that were buying the auditors would still want to buy bent auditors, wouldn't they? That's the problem, because they want to cook the books.
Okay, and also let's go to Prime Minister's questions, because there was some financial question this week there posed by John McDonald. He's the Labour MP for Hayes and Harlington, about QE2. This is the old quantitative easing. And apparently some of these commercial banks have been gaming the system. And so anyway, this is John McDonald speaking at Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday.
Donald. It was reported over a week ago that Bank of England had reprimanded one commercial bank, and there may be others, who tried to manipulate the gilts market to exploit quantitative easing. Could the Prime Minister ask for a report on this matter? And if it is true, that we explain to the bankers that we will use the full force of law against them if they try to rip off the taxpayer.
Yeah. Well said, John.
I think it's very important to send a message to all people in financial services that there isn't something called white-collar crime that is less serious than other crime. Crime is crime and should be investigated and prosecuted with the full force of the law.
That was a question from John McDonald, MP, Labour MP, at Prime Minister's Questions this week. This idea of... what is it? Is this something that's completely new to me. It's called gaming the system, Martin. How does it work?
Well, gaming the system is just a phrase for messing around with the rules, isn't it? I mean, you can game the system if you're playing poker.
Well, in this case...
it's not got a financial implication.
In this case...
gaming the system is just gaming the system.
In this case, it's where a bank buys gilts ahead of an auction. In this case, the 8.75% gilt maturing in 2017, which is part of this quantitative easing too, to push the price higher. It then sells the security back to the bank at a profit. I mean, this sounds incredible.
Yeah, because they know quantitative easing's coming, don't they? So what they do is they position themselves to benefit from it when it does.
And isn't it money? One of the reasons that the markets are doing quite well at the moment is because this is just the point at which this quantitative easing is kicking in. It's nothing to do necessarily with the Eurozone.
The US and British quantitative easing is basically... I mean, I find it very... Can't people see what's wrong with this? The economy's dead in the water because we're cutting public expenditure. Yeah. So we switch on a magic money machine to keep the banks going. I mean, this is bound to crash because it's becoming a one-way system of just debauching the currency. I know it's going to end in tears, and I think there's a wide understanding that it will end in tears, but nobody seems to be turning back from this.
Yeah, I think if you look in America, the way they've done all their quantitative easing there, you've still got your over 9% unemployed, and all the money, where have it gone? It certainly haven't gone to the right places. As Martin said, it's gone to the banks. It haven't gone... They're not lending any money out to anybody, to small companies, nothing like that. It's creating, as we all know, inflation. And it's the same here. We're being told at the moment the RPI is 5%. I think if you really looked into it with the price of oil, the price of everything else going up and up...
This is the retail price index.
The retail price index, yeah. I would bet that it's far higher than they're saying.
Well, can I just say on that, on inflation, when house prices rise by hundreds of thousands of pounds in 10 years, and when stock markets rise from a few thousand points to, 30,000 points in 10, that is inflation.
Yes.
Of course it is. It's asset inflation.
Totally agree.
Now, from the financial crisis on to what people are doing about it. Well, that's the Occupy movement, of course, in New York. Many other cities right across the Western world as of a few weeks ago, including in just outside St. Paul's Cathedral in London, where apparently the protesters wanted to camp outside the Stock Exchange, but instead they were kettled outside the cathedral, and here in Bristol, of course, on College Green. So let's first of all, though, hear from the canon of St. Paul's, who we heard earlier this week was unable to reconcile his conscience with evicting a protest camp, and he resigned. This is Canon Chancellor Reverend Giles Fraser. Let's have a listen to what he had to say.
I resigned because I believe that Chapter was set on a course of action that could ultimately lead to violence, to eviction, to protesters being forcibly moved on. And all that I've done in the last couple of weeks has been to try and sort this situation out without there being any force used in the name of the church, which I believe would be wrong. I think it's about the church using violence, and that's something that I believe that it shouldn't do.
But the church has been more than fair, hasn't it, to the protesters? It invited, gave them sanctuary and then asked them to move on.
I don't believe the church did give them sanctuary. I mean, no one actually gave protesters permission in any sense to be there. I mean, on the morning when I arrived, there was a line of police on the front steps of the cathedral, and I asked that those police who were barring entry for people coming to 8 o'clock communion to stand aside and for the protesters to stand aside. What that wasn't was any invitation for people to stay or to be there. I was asked if I believe in the right to free speech, and yes, I believe in the right to peaceful free speech. The idea that Chapter is divided, we take a different path on this particular issue. And the fact that I have unfortunately found myself unable to travel down this path with them in no way indicates that we're at odds with each other. I'm afraid for me it's just a matter of principle.
Well, the ironic thing here is, at least according to the BBC on their website, that St. Paul was apparently from a modern-day Eastern Turkey. He was born in Tarsus, and he was a tent maker by trade. Ray, this is a bit ironic, isn't it, that St. Paul's Cathedral is now, today we hear, collaborating, if you want, with the City of London to force an eviction on these people in St. Paul's in London.
Hmm. I think when you talk about St. Paul himself, St. Paul was a man who, when you think, he was to begin with a Jewish Sadducee who was very, very strict on the law, and he went on a trip to Damascus. Having went on that trip to Damascus, he heard a word from the Lord Jesus, and he became a Christian. Now, it's very difficult, I believe, to try and differentiate between the law and your beliefs, because I'm a Christian, and I find this very difficult.
So if you were in the position of one of the members of the chapter at St. Paul's, which you'd have to make a decision, which side would you come down on? You can't sit on the fence, can you?
No. Jesus, when he was asked about who they should pay taxes to, Caesar, should they pay taxes to Caesar or not, he got a coin and he looked at that coin and he said, whose picture is on that? Caesar's. Give to Caesar what is Caesar. Give to God what is God's.
But what's that got to do with whether you're going to violently evict people from a church?
Well, Jesus violently evicted a lot of people from the synagogue.
So are you saying that the money changers in the temple back in Jesus' day are like the people pitched out in their tents?
They're not
money changers, are they?
They're not money changers, no.
If anything, it's the City of London who are the money changers.
That's true. But the fact of the matter is, I think Jesus is also emphasising the fact that we shouldn't really break the law.
Martin, what's your thoughts on this one?
I think that it shouldn't be beyond the wit of the St. Paul's chapter to compromise about this. This is actually an opportunity for the church to show its relevance. I think back to the dictatorship in Chile in the 1970s, where people used the churches as places of refuge because they knew that that was the place where it would be really difficult for the riot police or whatever to get them. I think that Giles Fraser has actually come out of this very, very well. He's done his very best to try and get a compromise. They have opened it for that St. Paul's for worship today, because in actual fact the fire brigade came and said there is no health and safety issue here, and that's what the chapter were pretending earlier in the week.
So why was it closed for? Because we've seen the church closed for a week.
We don't really know what went on behind the scenes.
Do you think it was justified?
My mother was a Church of England priest. She's retired now, and I think the Church of England often finds itself in a bit of a dilemma in these situations because they suddenly thrust into the limelight and they haven't actually thought through what they're going to do or where they stand. But I think it's actually a sign of hope that St. Paul's Churchyard is being used as, because the rest of the City of London is just owned by private interests. St. Paul's Churchyard is actually a public space, and as through dialogue there's absolutely no reason in my mind why peaceful protesters can't stay in the churchyard and people go to worship and go into the church. But a lot of people are saying the only concern of St. Paul's is they're losing the £14.50 tourists because they closed the church. But it was said on Question Time last night, somebody said, look, throughout World War II, when bombs were dropping all over London, St. Paul's was open every day. So why are you closing it just because some people are camped in a tent 20 feet away?
Well, this is not just about St. Paul's, of course, because there are something like 10, I had a look on the internet, something like 10 different cities across Britain where there are these protest camps.
Well, this issue is also here in Bristol, on College Green, because it's owned by the cathedral and
leased,
by the council.
At least to the council. As we're about to find out from the Dean of Bristol, the very Reverend David Hoyle, who I spoke to yesterday.
My name's David Hoyle. I am the Dean of the Cathedral. The Dean is the head of the Cathedral Foundation. So, day-to-day, the Cathedral is actually governed by the chapter, but I chair chapter meetings. This is a medieval abbey. It was a community, actually originally, outside the city walls, but one of the great religious houses of Bristol. It was an Augustinian house. The oldest bits of the cathedral date back to the 1140s. There's a stunning Norman chapter house. At the Reformation in the 1540s, it became a cathedral because that's when Bristol became a diocese. That's when we got our first bishop. And there has been a dean and chapter here ever since.
What about the school? Because there's also a school attached. When did that arrive on the scene?
Almost certainly there were boys being taught in that old abbey, because they would have seen that as part of their job, and also that he'd been training people up to sing the services and to help in the abbey. We know from the Reformation, from the 1540s, that there was a school here, so this is actually one of the really ancient schools in Bristol. In the last few years, it's become an academy. We're really proud of our association with the school, which is going from strength to strength.
Now, you said it's a chapter that governs the cathedral. What is a chapter?
Chapter is made up of three of my colleagues who are ordained. That means that they, like me, are priests. Two of those people work day by day in the cathedral. A third is what we call a city canon. That's Tim Higgins, who has responsibility for St. Stephen's down near the watershed. And then there are also four lay members of chapter. So people involved one way or another in the life of the cathedral, together with the chapter clerk, who is the person who manages the life of this place day to day in many ways. We make decisions for the life of the cathedral.
Now, you say there's lay people involved, but people might think that's a little bit surprising, strange, that you've got people who aren't really connected with the church actually running the cathedral.
These are all people differently connected with the church. Some of them are actually members of the cathedral congregation, though the statutes of the cathedral want to make sure that we have some lay people who help us govern the place, and we bring some expertise in from outside. Every cathedral in the country now has a set of statutes that equips them in just the same way. It's an important part of a church that needs to think about it being a whole Christian community, lay and ordained, who govern the place. As a colleague of mine remarked the other day, as a business plan, it doesn't look brilliant. We're open all day, every day, 365 days a year, and we don't charge. But then we have been around for a very long time, and it does seem to work. So there are three services in the cathedral every day. We are open every day of the year.
Now, what about the little camp that sprung up outside? Because as you come out of the cathedral, through the large porch there, that's the first thing you see now.
It is. They're part of a worldwide movement. There are camps like this all over the world now, and rather famously there's another on the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral. So they've been with us now for something over a fortnight. We got a bit of advance notice that they were likely to arrive here. They didn't ask our permission. They have just moved onto our property. As neighbours go, they're working very hard at being courteous, and the relationships have been good, and I've been pleased about that. Of course, there are some pretty serious issues about them being there, so the position for me now is a rather tricky one. We haven't at any point said that we welcome their presence, because it does raise issues for us, but we are clear in our own mind that they have every right to protest. We're also actually clear that they're saying some pretty important things about the nature of the society we live in and what justice might look like. We want to take those things seriously. At the same time, we are responsible for College Green. We think it ought to be available to the people of Bristol. We are very aware that their being there now makes some of the other arrangements that we've got in place for other events happening on College Green difficult in the future.
It's the owners of the land, I would have thought, that will decide what ultimately happens.
That's true. We own the land, but it is leased to the council. So it's really important that we understand, and the council understand, Occupy Bristol understand, and the people of Bristol know that it's the cathedral and the city council who will now decide together what's the right response day by day to what's happening on the green. Our property, leased by the council and managed by the council.
What would you say to the idea that actually this is not actually physically the chapter's land, this is God's land?
That's a nice argument, and they've not said that to me. Biblically, I have to commend them. Their theology is really good. Doesn't alter the fact that actually I have a responsibility on behalf of chapter to manage the things that we've been given in theological terms. It may well be God's land, God's earth. I've got what's called stewardship of that.
what we're seeing now in many parts of the world is a genuine feeling, I think, that there's some sort of injustice at the heart of our economic system.
The Bible has quite a lot to say about the dangers of indebtedness. The Bible actually believes that there ought to be, on a fairly regular basis, what's called a year of jubilees, and that's a time when debts are wiped clean. The danger about debt, and I think the danger at the heart of a lot of our economic systems at the moment, is that what it does is to institutionalise a kind of injustice. If you like, it's a modern form of slavery in which one community will never escape their indebtedness to another community. To return to that point you made earlier about it being God's land, I think we are all supposed to be equally dependent on God. My concern about some of our financial structures at the moment is that actually what's happening is that some of us are becoming very dependent on other people. And in that system, there's an exercise of power that on occasions can look like injustice. But I need to make it clear that that's a theological explanation of what I think is going on. That's not a conversation I've had with the people on the Green, and I know that the bits of their agenda are probably rather different from the sort of things that I would want to say.
This idea of the Jubilee, we're talking about 3,000 years ago. How is this relevant today?
Behind the principle of Jubilee is the notion that it's crucial that communities are places of justice, and crucial that communities are places where relationships are well ordered. 3,000 years ago, the Jewish people were profoundly clear that strangers and aliens in the community, that the poor could be in a position of real discomfort and repression. The business about Jubilees was intended to address that and to prevent it becoming systematic. Yes, it was a long time ago, but actually poverty and repression, injustice, those are really modern topics. And I think the insight is fundamentally important. And certainly in the conversations that have happened about third world debt, there's been a recognition at times that it might actually be appropriate simply to write this off. I'm no economist, and there are all sorts of reasons why people might not want to do that. But the business about the systematic enslavement of one community by another, that raises some serious concerns.
That's one of the saxophonists from the camp on College Green, finishing that report there. And that was the Bristol's very Reverend David Hoyle, who's the Dean of Bristol Cathedral. Martin there, he was talking about systematic enslavement due to debt. I think this is actually will echo quite a lot with some of these protests around different parts of the world.
Well, I think he's right. I mean, obviously, basically, we've just agreed on Thursday, in theory, to write off 50% of Greece's debt. That's a jubilee, isn't it? Of course it is. And ultimately, as the economist Keynes said in the 30s, debts that can't be paid won't be paid. And that's not a political point, it's just a logical point. Greece can't pay, therefore they won't pay. And trying to make them pay is not going to get you anywhere.
Well, again, we only got to look at the courts in our own land when a person is in debt and he's got to go to court and you haven't got the money to pay. Can you pay £5 a week, or as it is now, 50p a week or so? I might be able to, and the debt is written off. And it, as I going back to what I said before, it seems that everybody got so much debt, and as we've been talking about Greece have got so much debt, and they want 50% of it cut off. They'll never pay it. The people in the street, they cannot pay their bills. The cost of fuel, the cost of housing now is such that people have not got the money. And the sad thing is, again, the bankers, a few years ago, was giving money away. Come and debt, come and have this, come and have that. And now we've come to the end. There is no more. It's over. I think when when the Tory Liberal government got in, did not the Labour say there's nothing in the kitty?
Yeah, but it's not just nothing in the national kitty, it's nothing in everybody's kitty because of the indebtedness. And of course, what was actually happening is real wages haven't risen, for example, in the United States since 1973. So what people were doing when they were taking these loans out was trying to keep their standard of living solid. So they were taking these debts, and for example, you remember when two people used to go out to work instead of one, just to keep the same level of standard of living.
You mean one instead of two?
There used to be one instead of two, but then two people start going just to keep the same standard of living.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you start borrowing. And of course, while the market's going up and your house prices is rising, it doesn't seem that dangerous to borrow. Yeah. And of course, that's how people are drawn into the debt trap. But of course,
is it really a trap?
Well, ultimately it is a trap, because what then, this a lot of this has been mis-selling of stuff by banks, but also the what they've done with it afterwards is, if I lend you money and then I sell that debt onto some third party, I don't care whether you can pay or not, do I? It's of no interest to me.
Yeah.
Once I've got you in debt and sold it onto somebody else, that's why building societies were originally mutual organisations where everybody knew everybody.
Martin, you make the banking the city sound like loan sharks.
It is like loan sharking. Of course it is. And what do you think they do to all these third world countries when they push the money down their throats? They say, oh, you can't pay your oil bill because we've whacked the oil price up. You'll have to have this money to pay it back. Oh, now you're in debt to us. Oh, now you're going to sell us your industries. Now you're going to privatise this.
Lending money and charging interest is not actually illegal, is it?
Well, no, but I mean, ultimately, interest. People get interest when they lend people money because they're running the risk that they're going to lose the money. That's why they're paid interest. Now, what's got to happen with the wealthy investing classes is, you've bet on the wrong thing. I'm afraid the ball has fallen on red, not black, where you've put your money. Now you are going to lose your money. That's why you got the interest in all the good years, because you were running the risk that when the ball fell on black, you were going to lose the lot. Now it's time to lose the lot.
Getting back to College Green and the situation with the camp, Occupy Bristol camp, there is a situation up in Birmingham where they have been given notice to vacate already. They've only been there for a couple of weeks, and the council wish apparently to reclaim the land on Victoria Square in Birmingham for the benefit and use, in inverted commas, of members of the public. In particular, but not exclusively, continued occupation of the site prevents and deters members of the public from use and enjoyment of these spaces. Now, we saw the Dean there very carefully sitting on the fence, not necessarily saying one thing or the other about whether the cathedral owned or stewarded land, as College Green, is going to actually be evicted. I want to get from you two, what would you do if you were on the chapter making this decision, Ray, from the English Democrat?
If I had to make the decision, in myself, I understand entirely why these guys and girls are trying to do what they're doing. The way certain people got far more, and like this says in America, 99% without, 1% with. I think, personally, we're in a very, very awkward position. Again, I'm a stickler for the law. If I wouldn't like to come home and find my house taken over by a lot of people.
But this is College Green. It's like a park, isn't it? It's not your house.
True, true.
So come on, let's have your answer. Which way would you go? Which way would you vote? Yes or no for the eviction on the chapter?
I personally would have to vote yes.
Martin?
I would probably vote no, but I would suggest that in actual fact it's quite possible to negotiate about these things, and that's in fact what is happening. I know that they were talking to both the council and the cathedral this morning, the people from the occupation, because I was down there this afternoon. But basically, there's no reason why, through dialogue, everybody can't be kept happy.
Okay, final story. A second undercover officer has been accused of misleading a court. Scotland Yard says it's reviewing the case of a second undercover police officer who stands accused of using a false identity in a criminal trial after being sent to infiltrate protest groups. Bob Lambert, who ran a network of police spies in the protest movement after living deep undercover himself, is suspected of having been prosecuted for distributing animal rights leaflets under his alias. Martin, we had a story about this last week, didn't we, too? Another one now.
Well, I think it's quite extraordinary that millions of pounds are being spent on these undercover operations chasing vegetarians and what have you. I mean, isn't there something better for the police to be spending its time doing? Blimey, there's plenty of organised criminal gangs that need a bit of infiltration. This is easy money, isn't it? You know, millions of pounds to infiltrate a few hippies.
Right, what about this?
I totally agree with what Martin's saying. It just seems strange to me that they're being used to do jobs like this. It just beats me. It seems that the fact that a lot of police now are supposedly being made redundant, where can they use the money? Because that's what we're being told, it's because of cost. They got money to get them to do this. It just seems so silly.
Yeah, it's public order issues. It should just be dealt with by the local bobby if somebody turns up.
Okay, well, time now for the Sky News at 6. Thanks very much to this week's guest, parliamentary candidate for the English Democrats Party, Ray Carr. After the news, an exclusive report from Norway on the far-right Masonic terrorist Anders Behring Breivik, man behind this August's Oslo bombing, which killed 77 people, along with the massacre. And also the British Constitution. That's after the news.
This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News.